latest news from Financeland with Wiley Sims from Smartline, station sponsor.
The information provided in this segment is general advice only. Listeners should seek individual advice from their accountant, financial advisor or broker to see if the product is right for their situation. ACL number 385325.
Good morning, Wiley. How are you today?
I'm great, Mitchell. Great day out there and good to see you again.
Absolutely. Now, today's topic's an interesting one. I think something that we haven't really done in the broad before, just trying to work out some of the big misunderstandings out there about home loans and maybe trying to clear up a few of these misconceptions. Because I think what happens, I'm sure you know about this more than me, is that rumours tend to spread around there and they don't necessarily have a basis in expert advice. So that's why we get an expert like you to come in and answer some of these questions that people have, and hopefully we can make people a bit more educated out there.
Yeah, Mitchell, and it's interesting. One of the first problems that we get is that I sometimes find that applicants shoot themselves in the foot and sabotage their home loan before they even apply. And there's a number of things that people often do which really either limits their capacity to borrow or in some cases precludes them from borrowing. One of the most common things that we find is that people have got multiple credit cards with very large limits on their credit cards. The problem that we get there is that the banks and all lenders assess you on your credit card limit, not how much you've actually got on the credit card. So it's not uncommon for me to find people that have maybe got two or three credit cards, maybe with $10,000 on each, no balance, they pay them off every month. But for every $10,000 worth of you've got on a credit card, you need $300 a month in income to be able to service that debt. And the rationale is that you can draw it all down as a cash out if you wanted to. So that $10,000 limit, you would need to have at least $300 worth of extra income to offset that. Now, the long and the short of it is if you've got lots of credit cards with large limits on them, it significantly cuts back on your borrowing capacity. So I'm not saying that the credit cards are necessarily a bad thing, but if you don't need them, you're better off closing them down or at least minimising the limit on them before you apply for the home loan, because it allows you to borrow more.
Very, very interesting. Now, also, you've come up with sort of five questions that people should be asking their broker or their lender, depending on who they're seeing. And these are a number of things that you have been touching on. I think it's good to just sort of go over them again and just summarize some of these important points. The first issue, what documents do people need to provide if they're trying to get finance?
Yeah, well, Mitchell, as we've mentioned in the past, and it's amazing, you know, we go and see people and they often scratch around and don't have these things available, but any lender's going to want proof of ID. So basically, you're going to need photographic ID there. We're finding that, again, with some of the regulations now, that some of the lending institutions are getting very, very sticky about this. It's not only proof of ID with a photo ID, but we've got one challenging difficulty in Victoria, and that is that a Victorian driver's licence would have Wiley J. Sims instead of Wiley John Sims. And there's one or two lenders that actually want to have proof ID that's actually got your middle name there. That's really challenging because secondary identification that's commonly used is Medicare. And again, it has first name, last name, and the middle given name is an initial. So unless you've got a passport, it can be very challenging. So for most people, if you've got a passport and a driver's license, happy days. If you haven't, you need some form of documentation that's going to have your middle name in there to be able to move forward. So again, that was something that was pretty easy in the past, and some of the lenders are getting very, very sticky about it again because they're getting their wrists smacked through some of the other institutions that they have to answer to, particularly with respect to ID and anti-money laundering and all this type of thing.
And I think a big deal now is the counter-terrorism efforts and trying to prevent money going to that particular purpose.
Yeah, well, that's the whole reason for it, Mitchell. And in fact, the very first thing you get in Mortgage Broking 101 is the Money Laundering, Anti-Money Laundering and Counter-Terrorism Act, and that's why we have to have photographic proof of ID. And again, so make sure that you've got at least a driver's license. A passport's the best thing because it has your full name there, but again, it doesn't have your address attached to it. So you need some form of identification that can both put your full name, date of birth, your signature, and also your address on it. So if we've got that thing, so we can tick that box off. You're also going to need a copy of bank statements. So it's either going to be evidence of deposit, if you're buying a new home, or alternatively, statements that are showing your previous home loan has been well looked after if it's something like a refinance that you're doing. You'll also need proof of assets and liabilities and also proof of your income. Pretty easy if you're a wage and salary earner. with the majority of lenders. If you've got a year-to-date pay slip, you're going to need one, sometimes up to three pay slips, the last three consecutive ones. And if you're self-employed, it's a little bit more challenging there because you're going to need to be able to prove your income for the last 2 years. So if you're purchasing a new home, you're going to need a contract of sale. As we said, if it's something like a construction, you're going to need plans, specifications, and approved, stamped approved plans, and a building permit as well, Mitchell.
Next question, can you give us a bit of a timeline? How long will a loan take to process? Because I imagine if people see a particular property that they want or a boat or something that they desperately want to get their hands on, they want to know how long it's going to take to organise finance.
That's one of the reasons, Mitchell, that we'd always recommend that if you're considering moving forward with a home loan in particular, that you get pre-approval if it's a new loan. It will depend on the lender, Mitch, and it's like saying how long is a piece of string. We've got some lenders that are actually taking up to 14 days to pick up a file and do the assessment. We've got others that we can get the loan fully approved in 3 days. And it varies from lender to lender, and it varies from in terms of the lender's appetite for new loan products. So we may find, for example, that a lender that may have had a very short assessment time, if they put something like a special on, it will often stretch their assessment lines out. So if somebody's in a situation that they want to actually get a loan quickly, we may recommend some lenders over others purely because of this assessment time. I've currently got one loan, and I won't mention the bank, but again, the people were quite happy to use this particular bank, but I forewarned them beforehand. I said it's going to take at least 10 to 14 days before they'll even pick up the file. So if you're not in a rush, we can get you a very sharp rate. But the reason the rate's so sharp and the reason the timeline's so long is because a lot of people are going to that particular lender. We've got other lenders that have got much more streamlined processes, and we can get them done much more quickly. But it does chop and change from lender to lender. And just because a lender was fast, you know, 6 months ago, doesn't necessarily mean they're fast now. Depends on their workloads.
And when you say it's been approved or they pick up the file, how long does it usually take from that point of something being approved to actually then getting the funds?
Well, it comes back to your first question, Mitchell. As long as we've got all the documentation, yeah. Not very long at all. So that's why we don't submit until we've got all the documentation, because we basically want, once the file is picked up by the assessor, we want all the documentation there. We'll generally do things like valuations as well, valuation reports beforehand. So it just goes through in one smooth process. So once it's in the hands of the assessor, if you've got the documentation all there and everything's ready and rearing to go, then generally it can be assessed first pass, and then the loan doc is approved that day, formally approved. And once it's formally approved, the loan documents would go out. But that would mean things a little bit different to pre-approval. If you're pre-approval, you have to then submit the contract of sale, for example, when you've purchased. But if it's something like a refi or you've already got the contract of sale, then you would submit that and go through in one pass, Mitchell.
Interest rates, how are they how do they work? You know, how do they accrue interest? What sorts of things should people be looking at there?
Well, with interest rates, basically, we've got variable rates, and variable rates go up and down basically depending on the cash rate and other factors. And we've spoken a lot about that in the past. We know that the first Tuesday of each month, apart from December, the RBA has a look at factors affecting the economy and will set the cash rate. And all variable loans and all loans are basically connected to that. But we know that there are other factors that are affecting this at the moment. For example, things like the amount of funds that have to be held in reserve now by the banks has increased. So that means there's less cash out there, and that's pushing rates up a little bit, apart from the cash rate that the RBA puts out, and also the cost of borrowing offshore, because a lot of our funds are borrowed offshore and it's a competitive world out there. So things like movements in interest rates in major economies like the US and to a lesser extent Europe and Japan also affect on our rates. So if rates were to push up there and you get a higher yield on interest rates in other countries, then that puts more pressure on banks and other institutions borrowing offshore to be able to lend here and pushes our interest rates up. So that variable rate floats up and down. And the lender can change a variable rate at any time simply by sending you a little letter out and say, congratulations, Mitchell, next month you're paying more interest. Where a fixed rate is locked in for a certain period of time. So you can generally lock in for 1, 2, 3, 5, 7 years, with most lenders in some cases 10 or even 15 years, but that's not the norm in Australia, having the longer term rates. Usually a five-year term is as long as most people go. But the problem with a fixed rate is there's an element of uncertainty there. So the longer the window, so a seven-year fixed rate loan is likely to be at a much higher rate than maybe a shorter term loan, say 2 or 3 years, where we've got some idea of what might happen into the future. The strength of fixed rate loans is, you know, for that fixed rate period that your repayment's going to be exactly the same. It will not go up or down in that fixed rate period. So if the interest rate is reduced, the variable rate, you're still going to be paying a higher rate potentially. But if the variable rate does go up, you'll be paying that same rate. So it's a situation that maybe you might want to hedge in some cases, and it is possible to partially fix the rate, some of it fixed and some of it variable, with the majority of lenders. So fixed rate's very useful in uncertain times or where interest rates are going up. And at the moment, because we're down at very, very low interest rates, we're suggesting to many of our borrowers that it's worthwhile considering fixed rates, because you know that rates are not going to increase. And if you're on a fixed income, or maybe if you're buying a new home or you're a first home buyer, it's comforting to know that your rates aren't going to change for a while.
And sorry, do you want to add something
else? Yeah, I was just going to say, the other thing is, with some lenders, they will offer an introductory rate for maybe 1 or 2 years, and then it will revert back to a standard variable rate. So these introductory rates, again, very handy for first-home buyers or for somebody maybe that's constructing, knowing that they're not going to get a higher rate, but it will revert to a higher rate later on. So it's about what we might term a honeymoon rate, Mitch.
Now, how much of a deposit will I need? This is, I think, a very big question, because people, I guess, don't really understand how much they will need in order to purchase their dream home that they see there.
Depends a little bit on your circumstance, Mitch, but the majority of the time we're going to say that you're going to need at least 10% of the purchase price of the property to move forward. Now, if you've had a previous home, I'd say almost definitely you're going to need 10%. Now, there's some guff out there about saying you need 5%, but the reality is around about 5.5% of your home or your purchase price is chewed up in expenses. So stamp duty and other expenses dealing with the home loan will chew up about 5%. So if you've got 10%, you're going to start the home loan with about a 95% borrow on the value of the loan or value of the property. Little bit different now with first home buyers, because first home buyers are exempt that stamp duty up to $600,000 or $650,000 on a sliding scale. So you may be able to do it a little bit less if you're a first home buyer, or if you've got somebody who's prepared to offer you something like a family guarantee. So it's going to depend a little bit, but ballpark, if you've got 10% of the purchase price of the property, you can usually move forward. There may be circumstances like family guarantees and first home buyers where you can do it on a little bit less, Mitchell.
And is this the right loan for me? How do people know that?
Well, you should always be getting the advice that you're getting from your broker, that you're getting a loan that's, quote, under the Act, not unsuitable for you. So basically, your broker should be asking you questions about your preferences with the loan. For example, things like, do you want fixed or variable rate? But what kind of things do you want with the loan? So the kind of thing we might ask is, say, is it important for you to be able to go to a branch, to be able to walk into a branch and do some over-the-counter banking? Are you comfortable with something like a lender who is a virtual lender or has a virtual network? In other words, they don't have too many branches. Do you want things like redraw on the loan? Do you want things like an ability to offset your loan against your savings? So all these factors are things that you should be asked when you're going for your home loan. So don't just go in there and just jump on the first home loan. Make sure you have a good think about the kind of attributes you want in that home loan before you move forward, and that will put you in a better situation to make sure that the loan's right for you. Again, and things like if there's an introductory rate there, you would need to know, for example, what rate you're going to go on in the future once that introductory rate expires. So you do need to ask those questions, Mitchell, and don't be bashful about it, because for the majority of people, it's the biggest expense they're ever going to go into is their home loan, so they need to get it right.
Now, comparison rates, explain that element of finance.
Look, this is really commonly misunderstood, and it's again a bit like saying, is the home loan right for me? A comparison rate is really what the loan cost you, and it looks at all of the costs involved in the home loan. So you may find, particularly in the electronic media, you find these very attractive interest rates jumping around your TV screen, and most people go, oh, well, I'm paying 4.2%, and look at that rate, it's 3.6. And I'll say, I'll go and refinance. But when you start factoring in costs, you may find that some of these very sharp rates, and I'm not saying all of them, but some of these very sharp rates have got other hidden costs in them. For example, there may be a hefty application fee. There may be an ongoing annual fee. And an ongoing annual fee, for example, over 30 years, if you're looking at something like a $300 per annum annual fee, that's going to come over $9,000, assuming that fee doesn't rise over 30 years. And when you compound that onto the loan, it can be quite expensive. So this is why we have a thing called a comparison rate. So a comparison rate says, okay, when we factor in all costs, when we factor in upfront costs, ongoing costs onto that rate, what is the real rate of the loan? So a quick example that we could consider, Mitchell, might be we've got two home loans. One home loan advertising an interest rate of 4%, another at 4.25%. With the home loan, the 4% one, a lot of people would jump onto that because 4% sounds cheaper than 4.25%. But if fees and charges work out at 0.5%, the comparison rate for that loan would be 4.5%. Where the 4.25% loan might only have fees and charges of 0.1%, meaning that the comparison rate, the real cost of the money, is 4.35%. So it means that what looks like a cheaper base rate or headline rate is actually more expensive when you factor in the fees and charges. So that's why you should always look at comparison rate. And comparison rate is usually determined, it's getting a little bit dated now, but it's usually on a loan of $150,000 where the comparison rate's done. But it allows you to compare loans with loans so that if you're comparing loan A and loan B, don't worry about what the head rate is. Always look at the comparison rate for those two loans because that's the real cost of your money moving forward, Mitch.
And last issue, loan redraw or offset accounts. Which one's best?
They're similar, Mitchell, but they work in a little bit different way. Basically, a redraw allows you to draw any money that you've paid in addition to the loan back off the loan. Where a offset account basically means that any funds that you've got sitting in the savings account are offset against the principal of the loan, and you don't get any interest on your savings if you've got an offset account, but it comes off the principal, which basically means that if you've got $10,000 in savings, it would come off the principal of the loan, you'd be paying $10,000, or your loan would be, the interest that's put on the loan would be $10,000 less than the balance of the loan in that month. So they operate in a similar way. It's just a sharp way of being able to mean if you've got excess funds, if you've got redraw or offset, you can work them in a very, very similar way, Mitchell. Although one gives you instant access where the other one you have to redraw it back out of the loan.
Fantastic. And before we let you go, specials this week?
Okay, our specials this week, again, we've got a number of lenders who are waiving application fees. That can save you up to $850 in the application fee, and still some very, very sharp rates out there on three-year fixed-rate loans, Mitch. And our most popular loan again this week has been our Smartline Select loan. So some very good opportunities out there for anyone who's looking to refinance or get into the home loan market, Mitchell.
And a topic for next time we catch up?
I think we're going to have a look at some common home loan solutions, Mitchell, because I thought we might have a look at some scenarios there and just some recent loans that we've done and saying this is how this person got their home loan moving forward, because people can often relate to other people's situations that might be similar to theirs, Mitchell.
And your number?
1300-280-342, and happy to help our listeners towards home ownership, Mitchell.
Thank you very much, Wiley. We'll catch up soon.
Cheers, Mitch.
Wiley Sims there from Smartline.
The information provided in this segment is general advice only. Listeners should seek individual advice from their accountant, financial advisor, or broker to see if the product is right for their situation. ACL number 385325.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye. Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.